And we can get started. This is cause number 18566CV, Chisholm Trail SUD Stakeholders Group versus the Chisholm Trail Special Utility District, Delton Robinson, Ed Pastor, Mike Sweeney, James Pletcher, Pat Gower, Robert Kostka, David, is it Massarang? Is that right? Kind of close-ish? Gary Goodman, Robert Johnson, in their official capacities and as directors of the Chisholm Trail Special Utility District and the City of Georgetown, Texas. And Mr. Allison, I guess we're going to start with you, please.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Jim Allison with Philip Arnold, with Allison Bass and Associates, representing the Chisholm Trail SUD Stakeholders Group, comprised of citizens and property owners of the district. They have brought this action against the Chisholm Trail Special Utility District and its Board of Directors, and the issues in this case involve alleged violations of the Texas Open Meetings Act. When this case was originally filed, there were other causes of action involved as well. However, those were resolved by a plea to the jurisdiction, and an interlocutory appeal followed, which upheld the plea to the jurisdiction. So the matter was then referred back to the trial court for proceeding on the TOMA, or Texas Open Meetings Act, allegations of violation. Now, of course, TOMA violations by their very nature involve a secretive proceeding. They involve an allegation that a public body has conducted itself in violation of the Act by not meeting the requirements of the Act to deliberate in open meetings. So the allegations that are in this lawsuit involve such alleged acts. Almost always the evidence of such are in the hands of the defendant. So it certainly behooves the plaintiff to bring forward allegations of those violations, but oftentimes discovery will be necessary in order to ferret out the evidence of any such wrongdoing. That has proved to be the case in this proceeding as well. When the matter was referred back to the trial court for proceedings on the Open Meetings Act violations, the plaintiffs filed their first amended petition, filed their second amended petition, and engaged in written discovery. Thereafter, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss, and the plaintiffs filed a third amended petition. When the matter came on for hearing on the motion to dismiss, the trial court struck the third amended petition and only allowed the proceeding on the second amended proceeding, and then thereafter limited discovery to only an allegation contained in a meeting in the second amended petition.
Were your second and third amended petitions untimely?
I do not think so. That's what I'm about to address. There is very significant, I think, in this case, that there had been no scheduling order entered in this case. There had been no trial setting in this case. As the court is well aware, under Rule 63, the normal rule would be that a plaintiff can amend, or a party can amend, their pleadings up to 7 days prior to trial, unless there's been a scheduling order entered that sets an earlier date.
But wasn't there an order from the court after the special exceptions were sustained that said that you have to replead within 30 days or something along those lines? And what was the effect of the stay on that 30 days?
Yes, there was a order entered on special exceptions prior to the interlocutory appeal saying that sustaining those special exceptions and requiring repleading on the TOMA allegations within 31 days of that order. The interlocutory appeal then intervened. And of course, it was impossible to comply with that 31-day order. You cannot file pleadings within the time that matters up on interlocutory appeal. So that deadline, if it was one, was impossible to perform, mm-hmm. and then passed by, as really indeed about a year and a half passed by, before the matter came back before the court. And
so
the plaintiff then filed the second pleading, amended petition, and the third amended petition before the court took up the question of the motion to dismiss. So there was no deadline in effect at the time the court took up that motion.
So it wouldn't have started ticking away again at the time after the mandate issued from the interlocutory?
No.
Okay.
And if it did, it would have applied to both the second amended petition and the third amended petition.
Well, now, the third amended petition was filed like the day before the hearing, correct?
It was. But both of those petitions were filed more than 31 days after the entry of the order and even 31 days after the matter was remanded.
Well, then substantively, is there a difference between the second and the third in terms of the TOMA claim that the court considered?
Yes, very significant difference.
I've got it, help me out here. Okay. Or you can just tell me and I'll find it.
Yep. Principally, the objection to the original petition, the first amended and the second, was that there was not enough detail about the allegations. And the third amended petition goes into excruciating detail to the fullest extent that the plaintiff was able to do so, considering there had only been 2 months of discovery allowed to the plaintiff. And in fact, I will come to this, the third amended petition then fleshes it out and alleges that there were rubber stamp meetings held, that there were meetings of less than a quorum for purposes of avoiding the act, and that the board then met and rubber stamped that, as we'll see as we get into the argument. And those are very significant pleadings that we believe, had the court allowed that pleading to go forward and discovery to take place under that pleading, that we would not be here today, that we would in fact have prevailed at trial. So I think the key elements are that the trial court, when it was faced with a motion to dismiss the second amended petition, and the third amended petition was filed shortly before the hearing on that motion, then preemptorily struck the third amended petition and said, no, I'm only going to allow the second. And yet there's no distinction. If there were a deadline, it had passed on both of them. So obviously we're back to Rule 63, and no scheduling order, no trial date, no deadline. The plaintiff was entitled to and did file a trial pleading, an amended petition that they were entitled to have considered. But the court struck it and said, I'm only going to allow you to proceed on the second amended, and then limited the discovery to allegations of one meeting from that petition, and then said you can only amend your petition with leave of court. Well, if we'd missed the deadline with the second petition and then the third petition, then obviously the leave of court would not be necessary as well. But the plaintiffs proceeded to finally compel discovery, had to file a motion to compel, to even get dates for depositions, and obtained a deposition of a board member and an administrative secretary to the board. And we have attached portions of that deposition testimony is attached both to the pleadings and to the brief in the matter before the court today. And then gave the court another chance and said, okay, we think our third amended was proper and was certainly within any deadlines, being no trial setting and no scheduling order. But here again, we're going to come back before you and file a motion to amend, because you told us in your order that you didn't say you can never amend, said, but you can only amend with leave of court. So we brought back the same pleading that we had filed before, which we continue to assert was our proper live pleading, and said, now we have had discovery, there's even more reason to allow us to amend and file this pleading. And that motion was denied. And then the court took up a motion for summary judgment on the second amended petition. Clearly, that motion addresses only the second amended petition. and granted summary judgment based on the second amended petition.
So then, are you addressing, in this proceeding, are you addressing the order granting the special exceptions?
We are addressing the granting of summary judgment, in this case, a final judgment.
Right.
Based upon the second amended petition.
Do you have to address the special exceptions first?
No, because we never had a hearing on special exceptions on the third amended. If the third amended is our live pleading, then certainly.
What if the second is? Just for grins. If the, because that's what the court, well.
We really don't know, of course, what the court based its judgment on. There's no findings. It simply says that judgment is granted. So on the second amended petition. But our position is that that was error. There was error first in striking the third amended petition. There was then an opportunity for the trial court to cure that error and get back on the right track by granting the motion to amend and allowing the matter to proceed with the third amended, denied that, and then said, well, I'm going to rule and grant summary judgment on your second amended. That judgment cannot stand. The court cannot deny the plaintiff the right to amend the petition on the facts of this case. When there's no scheduling order, no trial date, and not even a claim of surprise on the part of the other party, there is a right to amend.
In the briefing, though, it seems to address these other issues as opposed to the grounds that were raised and considered in the motion for summary judgment. I think that's where my confusion is stemming from.
They're addressed mostly in the reply brief because the appellee raised, I don't think they're relevant to this proceeding. I think the issue before this court is if the court erred in not allowing and striking the third amended petition, and then not allowing an amendment to file a third amended petition, this one or some third amended petition, if that was error, then granting judgment on the second amended petition cannot stand. The cases that we've cited hold that, particularly the Davies barbecue case, says if the court errs in striking a pleading, it cannot then dismiss the case based on an earlier other pleading. The only way to remedy this situation is to go back to the trial court and say, allow the filing of the third amended petition and proceed from there. Certainly the court can enter deadlines, can enter scheduling order, can set trial dates,
so
but
the
that
relief
was never
that,
done.
The relief
case.
That you're seeking is really not, it is to allow the filing and then convene another hearing on the motion for summary judgment?
That could be done. There's never been a motion for summary judgment filed in regard to the third amended petition. So we will be back to where we should have been when we filed the third amended petition. That's a live pleading. Defendant can file whatever he wants. He can file additional special exceptions or motion for summary judgment or motion to dismiss, but that's never been done on the third amended.
And you're not challenging the order on the special exceptions in this appeal?
Not in this appeal.
Okay.
What we're appealing, of course, is the final judgment.
Correct.
In effect, the court, by making its mistake and striking that pleading, has created a situation where now the only possible remedy is to send it back for proper proceedings on the third amended petition.
Well, could you even raise the order on the motion to amend the petition before the final summary judgment was entered?
Well, we tried to by way of mandamus. That was a potential remedy. This court decided not to hear that, as was your right, and you could wait until we had a final judgment, which we did.
May it please the court, and importantly, may it please the young people behind here. I'm
I was a little nervous in front of the judges, but I don't want these folks going back to school talking about the worst oral argument they've ever seen.
We have a lot of summer interns here.
Well, I hope I do all right. Yeah, Your Honor, as I've advanced some in my age, I'm less patient than I used to be, and I'm a skip to the end and read the last page first kind of guy. And Your Honor asked the question that got to the last page first, so let's go there. And that is the summary judgment. The ending here is that the summary judgment was correct. The plaintiff's discussion of amending or not amending is of no moment with respect to the summary judgment. Summary judgment was presented on grounds that were not rebutted with any evidence, and no appellate point was raised, by the way, that the evidentiary basis for that summary judgment was improper. The basis for attacking the summary judgment and their appeal is literally one page of text on page 17 and 18 of their brief. And here's what's important. The reason it's of no moment is because we all know a summary judgment can attack any element of a claim to defeat that claim. This summary judgment attacked the relief requested. You cannot get the relief requested. The relief requested is verbatim in both the second amended and third amended petition. It is declare that the agreement and transfer between CT Sud and Georgetown is void. And the summary judgment motion said you can't get that declaration because the vote on the live version agreement was a valid vote. And
so of course, is it your position that regardless of whether it's a second or third, the summary judgment stands?
Let's hypothetically say it was error not to admit that. Because it was on the same evidentiary basis, it was harmless. It would have been harmless error. But it was no error at all.
Because so one of my questions that I was going to have coming in here was the amended pleadings were not effective because they weren't timely filed, remained effective, or there's no way you could ever cure the defect, i.e. the void, the claim for relief.
All three.
All three, okay.
All three, Your Honor. And I mean, I can skip ahead to that. I mean, I do think discussing the special exceptions process, I mean, it puts us in rarefied air of you know, law professors and bizarre CLEs, because Rule 91 is the neglected rule, isn't it? Nobody pays attention to special exceptions and how they work. But we can talk about that, because, again, their only point of error raised on summary judgment is wrong pleading. You consider the wrong pleading, not the evidence of you can't void a transaction because the Open Meetings Act only allows you to void a specific action. A vote. And the evidence was that the vote on the live agreement was valid. And only in their reply brief, so not as a 38.1F appellate point, but only in their reply brief do they raise, well, yeah, but there were defects in the earlier votes too on the first version of the agreement and the First Amendment. Problem is, that would have been a basis to attack the validity of the 2015 vote on the Second Amended Agreement. They didn't introduce evidence showing that this vote was illegal or that this vote was illegal. No evidence showing any of those three votes. We showed the evidence that the vote on the live agreement was illegal. And if they're alleging that, no, that's not valid because it's a rubber stamp, then you have to show that. They didn't. So on to the special exceptions, Your Honor. These were used correctly. Everything else in this case was all other claims were stricken. In 2016, we filed special exceptions because they pleaded a vague Open Meetings Act claim. And that's the right pleading. It's the right thing to do. And the court issued an order. And for Mr. Allison to say no scheduling order is in place, that's mistaken. Because a special exceptions order granting special exceptions does two things. Replead by a date certain or be dismissed.
Well, but he couldn't replead by a date certain because the appellate stay was in effect.
It was by 31 days. And we don't disagree that the appellate stay interrupts any period that runs.
So and we even pick up the time.
You pick up the time. We even granted him the benefit of the doubt, saying, look, maybe it's 31 days from when the mandate issues and you're back in court. Nothing. No amended pleading was filed until we sent a letter saying, guys, you got a repleading deadline. Then they filed the second amended petition, which added literally one claim.
The
October 18, 2012 executive session meeting claim. and we properly then do the next step in a Rule 91 process, well, you didn't do what you needed to do. Dismiss everything else. You've pleaded a facial claim here. We'll deal with that later. But dismiss everything else. And on the eve of hearing on that claim, they tried to file a Third Amendment petition. Justice Triana, exercising the control over her court and having gotten the full briefing and pleading, did not allow them to then later submit because, again, by their argument, it's, well, okay, I know you told me to replead, but here, did I get it right? No? Well, how about now? Well, how about now? Well, how about now? Didn't work in my house when my kids wanted a cookie, and it doesn't work under the rules of civil procedure. And it is important, Your Honor has asked about it, and you're right. The controlling issue starts with the first order. The first order found their pleading deficient in July, in 2016.
Not the 18 one, the one in
September. Correct. Okay. The original order granting the special exceptions. And we know that your right to replead is limited. You don't have an absolute right to reinstate the cause. We cited Cruz v. Morris, explaining that, you know, you can't just come back and be excused from complying and try to comply again at a later time. So maybe an easy way to think about it is harmonizing Rule 91, special except, then the court's 2016 order, granting the special exceptions and ordering plaintiff to replead, and then the holding in Cruz saying, you better replead. The rule is effectively, after special exceptions are granted, you have one chance to replead your claim. Don't blow it. The implication of Rule 63 would void Rule 91. It would void the court controlling its docket. It would void any of the meaning of special exceptions at all. You could just keep coming back to the well and coming back to the well. And the argument of, well, then special except to my new claim. I already did special except to that claim. I already did, sorry, petition. I already did special except to it. So now let's talk about why the decision not to grant leave to amend was a proper exercise of discretion. They had a chance to replead. Understand, this case was up on state. It was 2 years to investigate your claim. And the idea of, well, let me file a claim and assert facts and then go do discovery after the fact, I get that that's an impediment of any claim, not just Open Meetings Act, any claim in which you say, well, I think there was something shady going on, but, you know, they control the evidence. You've got to be able to plead a bare allegation. And here's something that's important. In this third amended petition, there is no allegation that the 2015 vote, the act you would void on the second amended contract, was illegal. There's no allegation that the vote, the action on the first contract iteration in 2013 was illegal, nor is there one on the 2014 amendment on the vote. They allege a lot of things that happened before and around, et cetera, executive session violations and all that, and we cited the Olympic Waste case, which lays out that exact sequence. Even if you have an illegal executive session, that can be an Open Meetings Act violation. The individuals participating in it are subject to civil criminal repercussions, et cetera.
But once they vote in public, that's it?
Once they go public and have a proper vote, that's the deal. That's been done. Now, the second problem here is that the motion for leave wasn't even a proper motion. I mean, again, we're going back to base rules of civil procedure kind of thing that, you know, you pull it off your shelf and blow the dust off of, Rule 21. A motion has to state the grounds upon which it clearly state its basis and support its basis. They filed a motion for leave to amend to file this third amended petition. The motion talked about new facts. Not a single one of those new facts is alleged in this petition. They moved for leave to file a petition that they didn't even file.
Would your argument be any different if there were new facts in the Third Amendment petition?
Nope. Still wouldn't have been. Because none of those facts, if we even dig down into reading the evidence that they attached to their summary judgment, et cetera, none of it established that the vote, again, they were trying to void an action approving a contract and transaction. And none of that evidence went towards proving that that transaction was voted on illegally. At the best, they had arguments and evidence that there had been some improper executive session, that some committee may have been formed improperly, that, by the way, did not take any action. No allegation that the committee voted and took some action that bound CG Sud at all. It couldn't. It didn't. Every contract iteration here was voted on and approved in a valid open public meeting. We put forth evidence of the live contract, which superseded and amended all prior versions. That's the contract. It's the only one that's enforceable. And here it is. And they didn't rebut it. And importantly, there is no appellate point on that. So the third reason that the motion for leave was properly denied is that it was presented in connection with a summary judgment which sought summary judgment based on the relief requested, which was identical. In either petition, your ultimate relief was void the transaction. We presented the evidence why you couldn't void that transaction. Didn't matter whether it was the third or the second amended petition, rebut the evidence. That's our claim. You can't void the transaction. It could have been a bare petition of, you did some stuff bad, and you should void the transaction. We could have gone forward with summary judgment on that petition, said, we're not going to worry about specially accepting that you did some stuff bad. We're just going to prove affirmatively that this is a validly approved transaction. And once we did that, it doesn't matter how they amend or try to amend. The fourth reason, and this is a big one, this is the gatekeeper function of the court once you've put in place the now you need leave to amend requirement, which orders contain all the time. And that's the gatekeeper function of the court. This petition, to the extent the third amended petition raised anything new, it had two big problems. One, every one of the alleged wrongful acts. And remember, the law on the Open Meetings Act is that every violation of the Open Meetings Act is a discrete violation. It's a standalone thing. There's no pattern of, well, the first time I had a violation talking about the new Austin Convention Center was in 2011, and then in 2015 I talked about it again. So that's all one. No, they're each discrete violations. Every one of those was outside of the statute of limitations. It was facially defective. And importantly, with respect to the relief requested, this petition didn't allege that any of the votes violated the Open Meetings Act.
What about the injunction and enjoining? What about that?
Enjoining the future violations? And that's, we cited briefly, I think it was the Corner v. Garland case on functionally, once it has happened, the injunction is only there to remedy against unexpected future violation.
So once the contract was formed,
there's nothing to enjoin. Now, I mean, again, if for example, if you know, an Austin City Council member participates in an illegal executive session and there is a vote, and they even cite a Attorney General's opinion, which actually goes kind of this point. Let's say there's an illegal executive session or walking quorum, and then a legal vote. There's still criminal penalty and risk and a means of enforcement against the wrongful action outside of the Open Meetings Act. But the action of the body in compliance with the Open Meetings Act is not subject to being voided and is not subject to injunction. And you don't enjoin future activity of, well, you were naughty before. Don't be naughty again. It has to be a specific injunction. So once that ship has sailed, the ship has sailed. And that's, I mean, that's really consistent with injunction law broadly. So on the motion for leave not being proper, by the way, I do want to remind the court that we cited the Silsby Hospital case, a nice East Texas hospital case, telling us that when the matter pleaded appears to have been known by the party seeking to amend and is not based on any newly discovered facts, the court does not abuse its discretion in refusing to allow the amendment. The third amended petition was attempted to be filed months before. They refiled the identical document down to the exact certificate of service from the previous filing. It's kind of axiomatic that something you pleaded 5 months ago and then you attempt to refile is not based on newly discovered facts. they had some newly discovered facts of no moment and no relevance to the summary judgment, but they aren't even in this pleading. So it is absolutely within the court's discretion to say, you just tried to refile something you filed 5 months ago. That can't be based on newly discovered facts. Something else I wanted to raise that Mr. Allison brought up, at least, and this is important because, again, and I'm going back to Rule 38.1F on preserving appellate points a couple of times here because it's an important rule. He raised the issue of, well, we should have been allowed to do discovery. There is no motion, there is no appellate point on that, and most importantly, there is no preservation of error at the trial court level. If I file a motion for summary judgment and you need to conduct discovery to defend against that summary judgment, you just don't have the evidence in hand, but you think you can get some, there's an exact process on that that's kind of a sister process to a bill of review. And that is 166AG and 252. You have to file a sworn, verified affidavit motion for continuance that states the specific evidence that you seek to obtain and demonstrates that it's material and would enable you to defeat the summary judgment. So if I filed suit against you for running a red light and hitting my client's car and you file a quick summary judgment motion, I could file a motion for continuance that says, I want to take the depositions of these two witnesses who saw it. I believe their testimony will show that the light was red when you went through it, and that will defeat your summary judgment because you based it on the fact that the light was green. And please allow me the opportunity to conduct that additional discovery. The court would then hopefully grant my continuance to conduct that specific discovery so that I could respond to the motion for summary judgment. There's no such thing here. There's a motion for continuance in the file. It's a bare motion for continuance that literally says we sent out some discovery that was, you know, broader than the court would allow, and it's pending, and let them answer it. Nothing sworn, nothing specific, nothing tied to the summary judgment. And the punchline to all of it is none of that discovery went to the issue of whether any of the votes approving the agreement were valid. None of them would go to that. So on just a little bit, and I'm kind of pre-butting a little bit here because I know Mr. Allison has a significant amount of time, but regarding their idea on the Open Meetings Act and how it works, you know, well, gosh, your votes may have been legal, but those were rubber stamps of a prior walking quorum or executive session, et cetera. Well, we cited Olympic Waste for that very point. And it found in Olympic Waste that an executive session was conducted in violation of the act. But then right after that was a valid vote. And they found that the vote awarding the contract took place in open session after the violation occurred. And because the vote was not in violation, you're not entitled to the remedy of voiding the contract. That's exactly the kind of fact pattern here. And in fact, it makes sense because of the idea that some conversation in the chain of discussing a policy violated the Open Meetings Act, and therefore that subject is forever tainted. I mean, really, there's no way to cure. It would be the most beautiful weapon in the world for a dissenting council member to use. I oppose expansion of the convention center. Well, I'm going to make sure I call two or three of my buddies on the council and discuss this and engage in an illegal walking quorum. Then I'm going to report myself to a nice little watchdog group, which will sue. I will confess our sins, and we can never vote on expanding the convention center because, gosh, I've tainted the process by having an illegal conversation. That's not how it works. There's no authority on that. In fact, Olympic Waste and Fielding are contrary authority. So those specific acts matter. I mean, where we really are, Your Honor, all takes us back to the fundamental transaction that they want to void. The asset transfer agreement was voted on in a proper meeting. They could not get a remedy avoiding that vote. They didn't plead or introduce evidence to the contrary of that. There's none of that in the record, and none of that's a basis for their appeal. Only one raised was that it was based on the wrong pleading. But it was based on identical relief, pleaded in both petitions. They didn't raise a proper motion for continuance based on lack of evidence. Nothing in that third petition alleged that any of these votes were wrong. And bottom line, the way special exceptions work, if we need to go there, is you get your one chance to replead. Don't blow it. You don't get to go back to the well over and over and over again. This is a matter within the court's discretion, sound discretion, and don't kill Rule 91. It's an important rule.
Your Honor, I'd like to go straight to the bottom line also. So let's look at the third amended petition, because I fear that counsel has omitted some significant portions of it to try to make his argument. He's alleging that the only relief sought was to avoid the transfer agreement, whereby the district, in our opinion, gave away or transferred all its assets to the city of Georgetown. But if you look at the both the text of the petition itself and the prayer, you'll see that that's not accurate. In fact, the plaintiffs seek a declaratory judgment that the Chisholm Trail Sud and the district board members violated the Open Meetings Act. And then they go on and say, and conjunctive, declaring that the agreement and transfer is void. And they also seek an injunction enjoining and preventing the Sud and the board members from continuing to violate the Open Meetings Act. And the third amended petition, which the court never reached, but if we are to look at it and say that somehow its allegations are relevant to the summary judgment that was granted against the second amended petition, the third amended petition certainly goes into detail of the allegations and the relief sought, and seeks more than just setting aside the agreement. It seeks a declaratory judgment, an injunction, attorney's fees, and setting aside the agreement. Now, let's go quickly on the question of, can you set aside an agreement that has been ratified? We cite the Esperanza case, which I think properly outlines the proper analysis in that regard.
The Esperanza case, not the Olympia.
Olympia just goes so far. I agree that if you go, if what had actually happened, though, of course, we don't know what actually happened, because the court never considered the third amended. The court never allowed discovery on what happened in the meeting where they took the vote. But if they did.
Well, can you help me out? Was this allegation also in the second amended? Was this also, assuming the trial court was looking at the second, which I think that's where we are.
Not in detail.
It did not have the 12-1 A and B, and maybe not that number, but the substance of it.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I think that was added to flesh out. It had allegations that the meetings were improper.
Okay.
And then we went into detail on how they were improper in the third amended. And particularly, in order to ratify, you can't just call another meeting and take a vote. As Esperanza says.
But what was the relief that y'all were seeking in the second amended, and how did that vary from the relief that you were seeking in the third amended? Okay.
Both of them do seek to set aside the transfer agreement, but they also seek to in a declaration that violations have occurred, and those are much more detailed. In the third amended, we detail that they improperly met with counsel under the exception for litigation and consultation with counsel. They met and discussed actual terms of the contract that is not allowed under the Open Meetings Act, that they held committee meetings at which they made decisions that were rubber stamped at the later meeting, and they held those meetings with the city of Georgetown, very much a violation of the Open Meetings Act. Now, we never got to conduct discovery on any of those because the court had already limited us to discovery on one meeting, an earlier meeting. That, of course, is where the court went astray.
Do you part company with the allegations that there were no sworn that the request for discovery was not sufficient to preserve the appellate point for review, i.e. wasn't sworn, it didn't have all the
red herring.
Okay.
Red herring. Doesn't matter. If we were entitled, and number one, we had already filed the third amended petition before the court ever took up the motion to dismiss the second. We had the third on file. It was our live pleading, and the court struck it. That's where the court would astray. If the court had said, all right, I'm going to take up this motion and consider it applying to your third amended, then we would have had the court adjudicating whether or not the third amended was a proper pleading. The court's never ruled that the third amended petition is insufficient. And to try to raise that now on appeal, when we never even got a chance to argue that, of course, would be improper, much less the fact that we never got a chance to do any discovery in regard to those allegations that are brought forth in the third amended.
What is your response that it doesn't matter if it was a second or third amended petition, the summary judgment would have been proper?
No, absolutely not. As well said, it absolutely is improper at this stage because we never even got the third amended considered. And that's the basis for our request that we feel you must reverse and remand back to consider the third amended petition. But we do not think that there will be a proper summary judgment motion lodged against the third amended. No, sir.
It hypothetically correct as to the second? And if I stepped on your toe, I apologize.
No, go ahead.
Was it hypothetically correct as to the second amended petition? Just hypothetically.
Actually, I don't think so. I think we pled sufficient there that we were entitled to go forward, and certainly there was not a showing for summary judgment. There was a material issue of fact about whether or not that meeting was improperly conducted. Now, it might have been enough there that we could not challenge the agreement, perhaps. That's been cured by the third, and they certainly cannot say that they can ratify it if it's nothing but a rubber stamp and no deliberations took place. The minutes are attached to the pleading and demonstrate there was no deliberations ever occurred. They just met back and took a vote. And that's exactly what Esperanza says is a violation of the act. If you could do that, you could conduct all the illegal meetings you want and just come back some point in the future and say, oh, you caught us, didn't you? Ha ha, we're just going to take another vote. That's not the way it works. You've got to go back and deliberate in public. And they never did that. They just came back, took another vote, and said, that's all we're going to do. So, in sum, the plaintiffs had a live pleading on file at the time the court acted on the motion to dismiss. The court refused to consider it, struck that pleading, and then limited the ability to replead without a scheduling order, without a trial setting, and then proceeded to limit discovery, allowing no discovery on the additional allegations in the third amended petition. And then on the basis of that, then refused to allow an amendment of pleading, even after the discovery that was taken showed that there were improper meetings, and so twice denied the plaintiff their right to bring before the court the evidence of the allegations in support of the allegations of violations of the Open Meetings Act for which they're entitled to relief. We believe certainly a declaration that you cannot meet with your attorney and discuss terms. You cannot meet with the opposing party, attorney's fees, and we believe it will show that they rubber stamped in that second meeting with no deliberations, and therefore the entire action was void or voidable. Thank you.
Did I step on your toes in terms of the last question?
No, it was fine.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, sir. And thank you, gentlemen. With that, the cause will be submitted, as will the Robertson case, if I did not say so earlier, and this court is now adjourned. Thank you.